Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Constructs Inspect and Adapt podcast. I am your host, Mark Griffin, Director of Customer Solutions here at Constructs. We're a team of software engineering experts founded by legendary author Steve McConnell. Here at Constructs, we believe every software team can be more successful at delivering higher levels of business value. During the last few podcasts, diligent listeners have heard us talk about retrospectives and parking a future podcast idea out in time. Well, that time has arrived, and today's discussion is all about that practice. What it is, why we do them, what a good retrospective looks like, and of course, some anti-patterns as well. I again engaged Constructs Senior Fellow Earl Beatty and VP of Consulting Jenny Stewart, as well as our principal consultant Steve Taki, to share their experiences. They helped me to better understand the practice, where organizations may struggle with its proper deployment, and to see how to make sure that your retros have the highest value. We begin the discussion as Earl gives us a little history lesson, so let's listen in.
Retrospectives is part of probably as old as human beings in a certain sense. It's Deming formalized it in the thing called the plan, do, check, act cycle, which I find amazingly confusing because I never figure out the difference between do and act, because it sounds like the same exact thing to me. But the idea was to say, hey, you did something, look what happened, and then take some action about making it different next time. Try some experiments. So it's been around forever. And it got incorporated in the agile cycles because one of the key agile things was inspect and adapt. Learn what's going on, do a small step, learn what's going on, make a correction, and continue on. This got formalized into the agile practice called retrospectives. We used to call them lessons learned meetings, project retrospectives. But what made the difference between a retrospective and the older project lessons learned or project retrospectives is the size, the increment chunk we're looking at. We wanted to get it down to a much smaller increment chunk. We were used to looking at whole project or whole releases or whole big milestones. We wanted to shrink that down to a much smaller size. And so when we talk about retrospectives today, we're usually trying to aim at the smaller unit.
Yeah. Back when I got into the industry, oh, so many years ago, we called them postmortems. Literally
postmortems. People hated that title.
That term.
Yeah. Well, no one liked that term, but it's like, it's dead. Well, project was dead by then.
Right.
Yeah.
But just so that you know, Earl, the plan, do, check, act, the difference between do and act is that do is a prototype, an experiment, a sandbox to check it, test it out. And if it did work, then the act is to more broadly deploy it.
Right. But they sound like the same word to most human beings.
They do, but the scope is different.
So I created my own. I call it AXOR. Analyze, experiment, observe, refine, or replicate or something, right?
Yeah.
AXOR. Much more intelligent words.
Sounds like a Greek god or something.
Well, I used to call it AOR.
I don't care what anybody calls it. As long as people actually do something based on the conversation, you'll be miles ahead of many of the groups.
Sounds like a medicine to me. I don't know.
Take some AXOR.
Talk to your doctor about AXOR.
You might be right for
side AXOR. Effects.
Yeah, you might be ready for AXOR.
Side effects may include.
I used to call it AOR, but AOR for experiment with an E. AOR, someone told me, sounded like a donkey from Winnie the Pooh. So it went to
exactly.
AXOR, which sounded
AOR.
More like a transformer, more manly, more tough. AXOR.
I don't think it's going to work, Earl.
Not gonna work. But Jenny brings up a really important point here is, and what Steve was talking about too, is that the key to all this is actually taking that action step, doing the experiment and then acting on that experiment, not just having the gripe session that Jenny talked about earlier. You want to elaborate, Jenny?
I don't know how many times I go in and I teach like Scrum, which has retros built into it. And I say, yeah, you get together in a meeting, you talk about what worked and what didn't work. And then you go away. You get together in another meeting, you talk about what worked and what didn't work, and you go away. And somebody in like the third or fourth or fifth retrospective says, these are a complete waste of time. And I say, yes, they are an utter waste of time because you're not doing anything. And the whole class kind of goes, right? They're like, yeah, okay. Or the other thing I see is people will come out with a list of like 10 things. And then you get together in the next retrospective and they've done zero, because 10 was too many to take on. One of the real keys here is to pick an action, make it super concrete, because the other thing I see teams doing all the time is sort of this hand wavy, we need to improve in area X. We need better refinement. Great. That's an area you can make better. What specifically are you actually going to change in the next 2 weeks to make your refinement better? Are you adding a refinement meeting? Are you changing the time of the meeting? Are you changing the activities that happen in the meeting? Are you changing who's coming to the meeting? Give me a concrete thing you're going to try out. And too many people either don't talk about the actions or only take them to this hand-wavy state where you can't really act on them. And so what are you talking about in the next retro? Exactly what you were talking about before. But you're kind of going through the motions of the retrospective, but you're getting none of the actual benefit of doing a retrospective.
Would you trace some of that to a lack of organizational responsibility? Nobody has been assigned the activity of doing something with the results that come out of the meeting? Is there a structure within the Agile community that says this is who is responsible for taking those things and experimenting or putting them into a new process?
There's enough structure in who should be running it that it shouldn't be an issue. This is something where no team should ever say, this issue is an organizational problem that we can't get over. The Scrum Master is responsible for running the retrospective meeting and therefore responsible for talking with the team about how we're going to take an action. When you get to the hand wavy, we need to make an improvement in how we do sprint planning, the Scrum Master is the backstop to stop and say, okay, that's a great area for improvement. Everybody take, 2 minutes and jot down 2 to 3 things that we could specifically do differently in our next sprint planning meeting that would make this a better meeting for you. So they're responsible for taking that to the next step. I always tell people, you want to spend about 2/3 of the retrospective talking about what's working, what's not working, and 1/3 of the retrospective talking about explicitly what are we going to do differently next time, what is the change we're going to make, and who needs to make that change. And one of my favorite changes in the Scrum Guide, an iteration or two ago, is they actually suggested putting your retrospective improvement into your backlog. They're into your product backlog or into your sprint backlog, either product backlog and then into the sprint backlog or just a line item in the sprint backlog. I'd actually been recommending that trick for a long time to give the team a little placeholder to talk about what specifically are we going to do. So either you're doing it in the retro yourself or you can do it in the sprint planning meeting. But in my mind, there's no reason it shouldn't be happening other than we probably have somebody who's in the Scrum Master role who probably ended up there by default. Everybody looks around and says, who didn't take a step backwards? So organizationally, they may not have been trained to do it well. We can blame the organization at that level for it. They not have had the skills in how to handle retrospectives well. We may need to give them some education and some resources to do it.
But you talked about a model. I know in some of your clients were advocating for a rotation program where people rotate into the role just so they understand what that means. What happens in that scenario where maybe a team doesn't even have a Scrum Master?
Well, if you're a Scrum team, we need to have a long, hard discussion with the management and the organization about staffing the roles.
There you go.
And figure out how we're going to do that. We need to get the roles staffed. I'm actually not a huge fan of Scrum Master rotation, just because I don't think everybody does the job really well. Not everybody likes it. Not everybody does it well. I'm okay with rotation if you're rotating people in to kind of determine who you think's going to be the person who does it on an ongoing basis. And then I'm also...
So test runs.
Test runs, right? And then stabilize it. And then, of course, you know what? Scrum Masters do take breaks and have vacations.
Somebody has to step in, sure.
Yeah, you may ask somebody to step in and lead sprint planning in a retro and like have them watch one, you help coach one, and then they do one while you're away kind of thing to help kind of diffuse that knowledge into the broader team so that there's other people who can help. But the idea that every sprint or every 2 sprints, we're just going to rotate through all the team members, I have not found that works well.
a number of people really don't even want to do the job. I mean, it was joked that one reason that many of us are in the software industry to begin with is that we'd rather talk to computers than talk to people.
Oh, my goodness. There's a subject for a whole nother podcast.
Oh, yeah.
The persona of a software engineer.
I like to bring out a little aspect of Jenny and maybe have Jenny and Steve comment on it. And way back in the day, the IBM and its version of Plan, Do, Check, Act called it the defect prevention process. It was still looking at how do we do things better, how to stop defects in particular. And it had two loops. One was the local loop. What are things that we as a team can actually do to help lower the stuff? And then there was an organizational loop that had to go to a queue of some kind, its own Kanban, its own backlog, and say, okay, these are things on the organizational queue, and there has to be an organizational improvement effort as well. So they saw it going on in two different loops. There was the local loop, and I think when we talk about retrospectives, we really want to focus a lot on the local loop. What can we as a team try to make it better? Even if it's scary, even if it's weird, but occasionally we're going to have to throw things out into the organizational loop because you're hiring the wrong people. Well, we can't change that. We need to fund a new position. We need to do that. There has to be some place for that to go. There's some accountability so people can say what's actually happening with that stuff as opposed to it went to the black hole of new ideas. And this is where Jenny's Scrum Master becomes really important because they're the ones that have to take it to that outside loop and then hold that outside loop accountable.
To Mark, your earlier question about this is where the organization can and should help. Mm-hmm. I think we've talked about this when we've talked about scaling agile, this organizational-wide or project-wide or product-wide retrospective is incredibly powerful. It's no reason that the team should stop. The teams need to stop. But as Earl was saying, they're going to find some set of stuff. A lot of the teams I've worked with, it's build stuff where they can't fix it on their own. It's just too big. It's beyond their span of control. Or I had a group once where the metrics the organization was actually using were disincentivizing a handoff between the people who were building the code and the people who were testing the code within the sprint boundary. Which is like the worst thing you could possibly do for a Scrum team. They're pulling the people apart. Those teams couldn't fix that. That needed to go to the leader of the product development organization so they could change the metrics that they were using. So Earl's point is a good solid point. The healthiest organizations have this, each team's doing their own. And then the product level is also doing, product or project level is also doing this as well.
So hierarchy in some respects.
Yeah, hierarchy in some respects.
You have these meetings, and what if the team comes up with 10 things? Is that unhealthy? Is it just irresponsible to have that much that you carry forward? You force the team into saying, okay, we're never going to do 10 in the next couple sprints. Let's do 3 and try.
Well, it's one sprint at a time. Are you going to do 10 in the next sprint?
Yeah, that's my point.
But it becomes an issue of prioritization. And one of the things we've done is looked at the idea of impact changeability. How much impact will it be if we actually do this? How much will it actually improve things? But then also getting back to Earl's idea of local versus outside, it's how much control do we have over being able to change it? Things that have high impact, high changeability, the things we have control over that are really going to make a difference, those are the things that we should put on first.
I like to encourage not too many concurrent experiments. Let's see if we can get one thing right. Because one of the things I also caution is if you're going to try something new, the first time you're going to try it, you're likely to suck at it because it's new. You've never done it before. You're learning. And so you have to go through it a few times. And I think you need to do something 3 to 5 cycles before you can start making an honest judgment. Do we want to keep this or not? Well, if your cycle, if something you're going to try is a sprint, that's 3 to 5 sprints that you're going to take to learn to figure out whether you think this is really working or not. Sometimes you can tell earlier it's working right off the bat. Sometimes you can tell earlier that it's horrible. But sometimes it's like, well, it might be better, but maybe we could tweak it a little bit, and see if it actually is doing something we want to do or not. And so how many of those can you constantly maintain? If you're going to try to do 10, and have 10 different cycles going and try to track that, I think you're crazy. We've got product to produce, not just improve ourselves. I try to keep them down to 3 or 4 tops, 4 concurrent experiments going at the same time.
It's the opposite issue, really, regardless of how many things are on the list of could do. Most of the time, it's just not actually doing anything for a variety of reasons. Unless there's really some level of pain, that the risk of changing appears to be bigger than the risk of just staying where we are.
The pain of change.
Right. There's legitimate pain being experienced, then there's an incentive. But if you've taken care of all the pain points, there's just sort of a natural reluctance to fall into old habits and just keep doing things the way we've always been doing them.
Jenny, what's the most typical thing you see when you, I mean, this is kind of a broad brush thing, but like people just say this is boring, this is not worth it. It peters out in some respects.
I'd say a couple things. One, people say it's a waste of time. Mm-hmm. And the most likely problem there is either they're identifying no actions at all, or they're identifying super vague hand-wavy actions, or they're identifying your list of 10, and that's way too much for us to actually have the bandwidth to truly address in the next sprint, so we don't do any of them. So there's something broken in the, how do we identify a concrete change we can actually go after?
Okay.
I'd say that's the most common thread. The other one that I'll see is teams who were really good for a while, but I think to Steve's point, they got kind of all the low-hanging fruit that was bugging them or was problematic, and so they've now kind of petered out because they're like, well, I don't know, things are working pretty good. Mm-hmm. We don't know what to talk about anymore. And this is where I get super excited. Okay, great. Well, now you're in a place where we can do something really awesome and start to use a little bit more of what Earl was talking about, where you're going to need probably multiple sprints to go after something bigger or more complicated. We're now at a point where I'm going to go in and talk to that team about maybe we want to go back to the Good to Great book that we all read years and years ago. We want to set a BHAG, a big, hairy, audacious goal, or we want to set up some form of what would it look like if we were awesome? We're all sitting around having some beverages one evening a year from now. If we were looking back and going, wow, we are amazing now, so much better than the team we were a year ago, how would we know? What kind of maybe metrics do we want to gather about ourselves or indicators can we put in place? And now let's use that BHAG or that measurement. Maybe we're like, hey, we want to be super technically excellent. We want our automation coverage to be at this level, and we want this amount of pair programming, and we want these other aspects of technical excellence that we want to put in place. Now we can use that in our retrospectives to kind of carve off small little changes that we can make that we might need to test out a couple of different times or test out a couple of different ways or really actually experiment on. We're going to try one thing for 2 sprints. Then we're going to try something else for 2 sprints, and then we're going to compare those 2 and see which really works for us. So now we're getting into like the land of a super awesome, amazing team.
One of the things that we've tried, run through some number of sprint retrospectives, but then when you get into the position of thinking, is the retrospective really going to help us? The question is, why don't we do a retrospective on the retrospectives?
This is some kind of recursion. Groundhog Day.
Well, but what's the goal of the respective retrospective is to consider what you have been doing and figure out how to do it better. And you've been doing a number of retrospectives. Why don't you consider how to do them better?
Do you see the situation where you perhaps don't advocate for having a retrospective for every sprint? Would you back off the frequency?
I would say that when we're in this sort of, we have a longer experiment that's going to take us a while, I'm not going to do away with them, but the check-ins might be a little shorter. Our initial, like, here's the experiment we're going to plan, and we think this is going to take 4 sprints for us to try out. I'm still going to want to check in every 2 weeks because I don't want to go 8 weeks without knowing whether maybe this has suddenly proven it's a terrible idea and we should get rid of it right away. We might have kind of shorter sessions where we're doing a quick check-in. Is this working the way we thought it can? What would we try differently next sprint? to Earl's point, the first time we might suck. So we need to check in and sort of say, huh, that was kind of hard. What should we try differently in the next sprint? So we might not be changing the area, but we might change some of the nuances of what we're doing. You know, we wanted to improve our acceptance criteria, and boy, that set that we picked were just super unhelpful and vague. How do we make them better next sprint so that they can be more useful to the planning that we're trying to do or something like that?
I think you're threading on it a little bit, but I'll throw this out. What are the elements of a really well-run retrospective? What would you say if you had the top three things that you want to see a team doing successfully in retros?
I would say I want to see some variation in the techniques that they're using inside of their retro, because these things can get very boring. And the most common retro that I see is what I call the go around the room retro. Hey, Earl, what worked and what didn't work? Mark, what worked and what didn't work? Steve, what worked and what didn't work? That can be fine for a little while, but if we've been doing this for 2 years, we're probably all a little bored. If I sat and observed a team over 5 or 6 retrospectives, I would want to see some variation in what they're doing based on what they're trying to accomplish in the retro. And usually that also includes some use of tooling that's there. I'd want to see a very specific, explicit focus on what are we doing next. So I'd want to see a concrete action or two, I'm okay with two, coming out and flowing into the next one. Earl was talking about this is a plan, do, check, act cycle. I want to actually see the do and the check. I want to see the prototyping, the do, and then, hey, did we get what we expected out of that? And then are we going to adjust? Are we going to keep, throw away, change, try something different based on what we learned over this? So that living and breathing. And then the last thing I would love to see is some level of what I call team health metrics. Metrics the team itself has put in place to identify what it thinks looks good to it. What are we trying to do maybe from a throughput perspective, a quality perspective, technical perspective that they're actually looking at to improve over time? And I guess the last thing I'd like to see is the team actually enjoys the retros.
Well, there you go.
All retros must include beer.
Well, that's a good point.
You dread going into this meeting. You're not going to have great retros if everybody dreads going into them. The team also says to me, our retros are fantastic. I'm a happy camper.
We joked about it, but would you ever hold a retrospective at a brew pub?
Yeah.
Get people out of their element, get away from the desk, away from the conference room, away from things, and just have them perhaps talk more freely about things they want to change.
Sure.
It could be a wine bar too, Jenny. I'm not
equal, you know, opportunity.
I'm not forcing the beer up here.
Well, and in our many, many, many teams being virtual, maybe we hold a retro in the late afternoon, early evening. That's kind of off work hours.
The retro tends to get sandwiched, though. If you're doing a switchover day, you tend to have the demo/review. Then you have a little retro. Then you go right into sprint planning. So it's often sandwiched in the middle of a day of a transition day as opposed to a separate event. Typically, in my experience, we tend to have those changeover days. We always go start with review, retro, planning.
Interesting, because I actually recommend that you don't do it all in a day. I recommend that you do review and retro in the afternoon of one day and sprint planning in the morning of the next day. So my teams would have a pretty easy time saying, well, we usually do our retros at 3, but this one we're going to have at 4:30.
That could work. Yeah. One of the things that Jenny wants to see that variation, this is where I personally have tried to run away from retrospectives as a scrum master, because I'm not into all the facilitation things like, wow, how can we make it fun and exciting this time? For people who are like, I really need to be here. Well, how I try to make it fun and exciting as a scrum master is I try to give them content they actually want to talk about and solve. I always follow a sort of 3-part pattern. I start with saying, hey, are there things we want to celebrate from the last sprint that, like, we were surprised that went really well. That went better than expected. What do we want to celebrate that we want to say, yeah, let's just make sure we're going to highlight on that? Because people like to hear a little pat on the back sometimes, and I think that's usually a positive start. Then I list anything that pains you. And I don't go around the room necessarily, but I just open it up saying, time for pain, and check for someone who hasn't been speaking. And then we look at ongoing experiments. And this will be dynamic. This will be changing. So we'll have different experiments at different times. And say, okay, what experiments we have running? Do we need to start new experiments, and do we need to stop any experiments, i.e. that we've learned enough that we either are doing it now, and so it's a kosher, it's already part of our practice, or it's like, no, let's do it something different, and let's kill this one off because it's not working. So we look at the state of the experiments, and do we start a new one, given the pains that we've already talked about? That one of the ways you keep it exciting is not by just sort of saying, hey, everyone, let's get you to force you to participate, but to actually have content that they actually care about and they want to talk about.
I think the best world would have a bit of both.
Probably, but I hate the facilitation crap. You know, it's like, oh, let's all get our smiley faces up on the wall.
See, I love that stuff.
Emotional dot voting, everyone.
Oh.
But you are the master of introducing new weird little technology bits to these events, or with your Miro stuff and all that. You find ways to get people to be more involved. That doesn't that fall into the category of facilitation? Are you kind of hedging on this thing a little bit? I'm calling you out there, Bowtie Man.
I'm hedging because it's certainly not one of my strengths. I came into computer programming because I didn't have to talk to humans.
Exactly.
Steve's point earlier on. And also, as a Scrum Master, you have to talk to humans all the freaking time and watch their emotional state. You know, as a good facilitator, part of your job is to watch who's not talking just as much as who is talking. And who is talking, are they talking too much? So if your retrospectives are dominated by two people out of your five-person team every time, you've got an issue there. Over half your team is not really participating. How do you change that dynamic? You have to start looking at different games, like, oh, maybe I need to create an anonymous channel initially so everyone has to write something. Affinity diagramming is a great tool of the toolbox. Affinity diagramming is what you do is you make everyone write things on sticky notes, but they can't speak. They just write on notes. And then as you as a master walk around and you collect the sticky notes and you get to read them out loud to sort of germinate other people's thoughts. And then you stick up all on a board, randomly on a board, and then you make the people come up and sort them into affinities. And then you can rank them. You can prioritize them as Steve talked about. You say, okay, which of these affinities sounds like the most pain in the butt thing that we want to fix? And then you can go through the same exercise again. How are we going to fix it? Everyone has to write ideas on how to fix this on sticky notes. Can't say a darn thing. This is a way to bring out the entire team as opposed to have two people dominating the conversation. I hate that stuff. I'm not good at it. I don't like doing it. I don't want to do it. And so we'll bring in Ellen Gottensteiner, who loves that kind of stuff, right? And other folks like that to make it work.
All of this stuff is core facilitation stuff that Earl is talking about. And actually, I guess, to just give some folks a nice concrete takeaway, if you have a team that is distributed, which a lot of our teams are now, getting something like Miro or Mural, one of those online whiteboarding tools that people can use so that you can have this thing like, all right, everybody take 2 minutes and write down three thoughts about what surprised us this sprint or what bugged us this sprint so that you get a little bit more of that. Let's make sure everybody participates. That can be a pretty easy shift to make inside of retrospectives to get more people contributing to the retros, because a lot of technical folks can be a little more introverted and maybe want a little bit more think time because they're pretty analytical. So you give them that space inside of retros, and that change alone can make them more fruitful.
Is it that we only consider what worked well, what didn't work well, what are we still confused about in the meeting? Can't we be thinking about those things during the active sprint and then have sort of like the suggestion box to drop them into so that we're not doing the discovery in the retrospective? We're going in with a box full. Now that we've got this box of things that people found during the sprint, why don't we talk?
I've seen teams who have done that and been very happy with that technique.
When I get to play Scrum Master, which I got to play last year for a while, part of my job is walking in the rush by saying, you may not think, but here's some things I noticed going on during the last sprint that you might want to think about. Because this seemed kind of weird, and this seemed kind of weird, and that seemed kind of weird, so what the heck? And you know, some of them say, well, that was a one-off, or we're not going to worry about that. It was like, okay, I'm just telling you, these are things that I saw that you may want to think about.
Earl actually makes a really strong and important point here. And I think that sometimes people think that, and we're talking a lot about Scrum and Scrum Masters, but I will say a lot of the Kanban teams I stand up, I recommend they steal from Scrum and do a retrospective like on a regular basis. So it can apply there too. Just a shout out to my Kanban folks. A good Scrum Master is interested in how the team operates and the team is operating well, healthy, fun, effective, productive, and using the Scrum framework in an effective manner too. They are often a little bit more on the outside looking in. And sometimes I think people think, I have to be 100% passive in retrospectives. I'm not allowed to sort of put things in front of the team and say, hey, I noticed, you know, hey, I've been looking at our metrics for the last 5 sprints, and we keep committing to 80 story points and delivering 20. Maybe this is a problem and we should talk about this. There is no reason on green earth why a Scrum Master shouldn't suggest. The way Earl described it, I think, is perfect. He said, I noticed, and then he allowed the team to say, I don't want to talk about that. And I bet, Earl, if you really thought it was important, you'd probably be back in another sprint or two saying, hey, you know, I noticed.
I still notice. I'm strongly noticing, and I'm really not buying your response. It is your response, but I still know. Yeah.
You're not going to say to the team, you have to talk about this. It is their retro, but there's no reason that you shouldn't be saying, hey, I've noticed this. Is this something we should be talking about?
Earl, I would challenge you. You mentioned something about you have a 5-person team and you set up a separate channel to have anonymous feedback. It's awful hard to imagine how you wouldn't figure out who was making comments in a 5-person team anonymously.
Not so much the anonymous in the long run. I think more of it's sort of the, we don't know who's writing what at that moment.
Okay.
I'm trying to avoid the groupthink problem where leader A says, oh, I think it's this. And everyone goes, well, okay, I guess that's it.
Right.
I haven't got any other input where I want a small period of time where everyone's thinking independently and forced to think independently. So we're not sharing yet. I guess it's maybe not anonymous. Maybe I'll call it delayed sharing. where you don't get to share right away, but you get to think right away. You have that thinking time, the sharing time. And to Steve's point earlier, there's no reason to go into this thing cold. You've been working all sprint. I don't mind in the daily that if the Scrum Master says, hey, just as a thing, anything you want me to write, jot down that you're noticing right now that we want to talk about in the retrospective, because I'll be your reminder for you. Because every day you're encountering stuff, and the daily is a good place to flush out a list of things you might want to consider doing in retrospective.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And it's this notion of spontaneity in retrospective versus planning. Maybe you do come in, maybe the Scrum Master comes in with a little bit of an agenda because they've already they've wandered around the team, they've listened to some things, they've picked up some stuff, and now it's like, you know, I'm curious. Let's explore this because it was something that they saw. Maybe you don't handle it right away. Maybe you bring it in at the retrospective. So you sort of have that forced agenda, kind of a heavyweight word, but, you know, just something that you say, okay, these are 3 things we want to talk about.
You probably should have jotted down or thought a little bit. If we're going to talk about this, what might I use as an approach? Might we just be doing the what worked and what didn't work? Or might this team kind of be at a point where maybe we need to reinvigorate what we're doing and therefore maybe we're going to use the sailboat retrospective technique, which is kind of what's the wind in our sails and what are the anchors holding us back? Or maybe we're working with a team where that kind of thing would cause them to roll their eyes. So I'm going to go dig into something that's a little more concrete because they're just not going to like that kind of thing. It's too woo-woo.
Woo-woo. I like that word.
I always tell Scrum Masters, you should come in with an idea of what you're going to do and have a few back pocket techniques just in case stuff goes off in a different direction.
One of the definitions of a leader, and we always say that the Scrum Master, whether we're doing it on Scrum or stealing it for Kanban, they always like to call it a servant leader. A lot of more emphasis on the servant part, but remember what a leader is supposed to do. A leader is supposed to paint in a compelling vision and help everyone else go toward that vision, right? Move toward that vision. as you engage in this retrospective, one of the things you should be doing, you should be saying, okay, I have a vision of what it means to be an awesome team. I have a vision of what, in my case, Scrum wants you to do, and you're not doing it yet for various reasons. Some of them make sense. Some of them don't make sense. They're just the way that you happen to be doing it. How do I make such a compelling vision, to Steve's point, that what you feel like you're doing now seems painful? I don't want to do that. I don't like doing that. I want to be better because your vision, Earl, sounds so compelling. Hey, how do I guide you? And I have to have some idea sometimes to help you make that next step, because one of the reasons you are where you are is because you don't know what to do. My job is to be like a half a step ahead of you and say, okay, why don't we try, you know, you could try this or you could try this to help them jump over that lip. Because if they already knew how to do it, they'd probably already be doing it, because it's hopefully it's a better thing rather than a stupid thing. Your job as a leader is to paint that vision and have some ideas to help them take that next step.
There's this transition that happens with really great teams. The first part is I'm leading them to get them to be a good, solid, basic Scrum team. We know what the rules are. We know how to play the game well. It's working really well for us. And then there might be a next step where we together create the vision for where are we going from here. Now that we can play well, how are we going to become superstars? And let's work together to build that vision of the next step we're going to take. But I think that idea of I am finding ways to inspire the team is really what Earl's talking about. And I think that is really important. And that's how you take this from we're just talking about crap to we're talking about stuff that's actually impactful and meaningful to us.
Good crap.
Good crap.
Good crap. We want good crap.
Useful crap.
Mechanically, should these be time boxed in the same way that like a stand up is time boxed, or do you leave them open ended, or do you leave it up to the Scrum Master to figure it out?
No, they're time boxed. If you're using them in Scrum, they are inherently time boxed because every event in Scrum is time boxed. If you're using just kind of a more general agile retrospective, I would still say, let's say for some reason we're using this to retrospective. There was a project that just suddenly went off the rails. We have the teams doing individual retrospectives, but now we're going to do a project level retrospective and look at the things that have happened over the last 3 months that have gone terribly wrong. I'm still going to time box that I'm not going to time box it to an hour because we have a longer period of time that we need to look at. We have 3 months that we're looking at. So I need more like probably a half a day, but these are tiring, and I'm not going to just let them run open-ended. I am going to have a time box, and I am actually going to spend some time thinking about what are the activities that we're going to be doing in the, as I think Earl, you were kind of calling it, the exploration phase. What are we going to be doing to figure out why did it go off the rails? How much time? What activities am I going to do? Now, as we transition into the what are we going to do about it, what's maybe 3 or 4 techniques I might be using here, depending on what issue came up that we can use. I'm actually going to put a fair amount of thinking and planning into preparing for this. I might get a little sloppy around the edges. I think we're going to end at 4, so I'm going to say we're going to end by 5, and we're probably going to land it at like 4:30, but we are going to call it at some point.
Within the big time box, you can have smaller time boxes. For example, part of every retrospective, when you get to the project level, seems to be the old Seinfeld Festivus airing of the grievances, where we're going to sit there and complain and moan about every darn thing that went wrong on this project. And that could suck up your entire agenda if you let it. So you got to put a hard stop and say, okay, we're going to hold the complaining to something like that. And if we've already complained about it once, we're not going to complain about it again. We've got that complaint, move on. Having mini time boxes within your bigger time boxes for the different kinds of things you want to explore during a retrospective.
And the amount of time that you spend, can I say, retrospecting should be a function of how much time are you looking at? I mean, okay, a sprint, 2 to 3 weeks. Are you looking at more sort of a quarterly kind of thing? The longer period of time that you're retrospecting over, the more time you need to do it. And the other thing is how frequently you're doing the retrospectives. For a lot of projects that I'm doing, well, have done in the past, sort of pre-Scrum, where we would have a weekly status meeting that we would retrospective the weekly status meeting in the last 7 minutes or so of the status meeting.
Here's something controversial. I'm going to lob out there. Is that I think the retrospective idea on larger period items, say over 2 months of duration, a major milestone, an old days, a whole release, something like that, I don't find them very effective. Why don't I find them very effective? Because you can't take the action. When you're doing that retrospective, you might be identifying things that you have to do in another 3 months, another 5 months. No one's going to remember in 3 to 5 months what you decided to do today and try to implement that correctly. And then when you first do it the first time, you're going to be bad at it. So then you've got another 3 to 5 months after that before you can make an improvement on how you did it badly. Well, each time you've got a whole new set of grievances. And so this is where we came up for years, what I always call the project lessons relearned. We keep relearning the same ones because we can never take action in enough consistently way to actually do the thing we wanted to do.
And another problem is the recency effect. Those things that we experience most recently are the ones we're going to tend to bring up. If you do waterfall retrospective at the entire project level, that you're just not going to remember all the things that happened back way in the early phases. Frequent retrospectives where you're not forgetting stuff that was hitting you before become very important.
In a way, you want to say, gosh, am I in an activity? Let's say we're in a major requirements part of the project or a major designing area. Don't wait till the end because you won't have that event again to try to improvement and for another period of time. Do it halfway through, a third of the way through, and start saying, okay, what do we like? What's going on here? What do we want to try different for the rest of this period of this particular kind of work? Maybe you're working on a major feature. We built a third of the feature. Well, maybe we now stop and go, what's going on here? Can we make a change?
I think your point is, how often are we going to do the same thing again? That these, we do it once at the end of a 9-month project, are deeply problematic, A, because you forget about everything that happened early on, and B, you're going to think more about the stuff that happened at the tail end, but then you're going to go work on the things that you forgot about most. But if you're going to have a slightly longer cycle, maybe you're doing quarterly releases, or maybe you're doing safe PIs, but you're going to do that same thing again coming up soon, and it's not 9 months long, it's 8 to 10 weeks, or maybe even 3 months. I do think the idea of having some rhythm to look at what can we do better across our entire release or across our entire PI. SAFE has the lessons learned built into it at the end of the PI increment, and we're going to go do another PI again. I think those can work quite well too. I would say if you're doing it at the end of a 9 month or 12 month project, go with Earl's approach and say, we're in X phase, halfway through or a third of the way through or a quarter of the way through that phase. Let's figure out what's working and not working and tune it right away.
Pile on Jenny here is, when you're doing retrospective, is to look at your increment length. And that question is, when are we going to do this thing again? When can I take the actions identified? As part of Steve's priority, I think he hit it right on the head. It's like, what do we have control over? What has we have the more influence on? If we're not going to do it again for another 4 months, let's find something that we do have influence on next sprint, next month, next week, something like that. That gives us a lot more ability to actually get empowered by our retrospective. A lot of times, I think retrospectives kill people off because they keep coming up with these good ideas for something that's 8 months out, 6 months out, 4 months out. And no one really remembers it. And the passion's kind of gone by then. And someone did write it down and they kind of bring it up. But, you know, that new moment has its own confusions and no one remembers to do it. Really, when you come down to it, this is a big part of change management. If you look at the world of change, this is what retrospectives like. Can we make a change? And Steve mentioned the pain part of it, but the clear next steps is also a really important part of change management. Someone has to know exactly what they need to do on that next step to try to implement the change. If they have that vaguey thing that Jenny's talking about, nothing will change. If we're very happy with the way things are, nothing's going to change. We got to have some pain. We got to have a clear idea where we're trying to go. And we have to have that clear next step for whoever's going to execute that. And if it's not you, me saying, oh, Steve, you need to change this because you sucked.
Well, of course.
Not going to go anywhere. Because first of all, Steve knows he doesn't suck. He's like, oh, Earl, you're full of it. And there's no control. There's none of that influence. So it's also to be the team should be looking at saying, what can we do? Not what someone else should do, but what can we do to move this forward?
Yeah, see if I bring beer to the next retrospective.
There you go. Yeah, if I run this next time, we're not having Bud Light.
Yeah, homebrew, so, come on.
We touched a little bit on some organizational culture issues, the notion of the fact that you do have a mix of people in the room. You have stronger personalities. You have introverts. You have people who don't want to contribute. You may even have people that have an issue with honesty. They'll say what they think people need to hear in a room, but outside of that room, maybe have different conversations. Does that play a role in success of retrospectives, how some of those things are handled? Is that something the Scrum Master is responsible for taking care of offline? There's a can of worms.
How many minutes do That's we have right. left?
Even things like openness to change, right? There are some people in the organization that might not be open to change. They just say, it works fine. You're nitpicking. Leave me alone. Let me go in my corner and write code.
That's where that leadership part comes in again. And it's going to be on somebody on the team. Typically on a Scrum team, we would put that mantle on the Scrum Master. But it could be anyone on the team. And what you're talking about is having those diplomatic skills to be able to talk to individuals and find where they're at. And of course, I've always loved, I don't know whose definition was, but a diplomat is a person who could tell you to go to hell in such a way that you look forward to the trip. That you have this ability to interact with human beings on any one-to-one level, which kind of again suggests, well, we got to be careful who we pick on that leadership role. They have to want to talk to other people, hear them, understand their concerns, help them see something different, help them take action. For example, Mark, you talked about the person who may not be honest. And then we'll grouch and say what people are. And here's where, as I Scrum Master, I've done this. I've gone to them after the meeting saying, you know, I noticed you said this in the meeting, but you've also said this to me too. Help me understand what's going on here. And do you need an advocate? Because they can't say it for safety reasons. And so they need an advocate. And so you say, I will be your advocate. I will come up and say, I see this and I don't think it's right. And then you can chime in if you want to, if you feel safe at that point. But let's get that out there and let me be your advocate. So you have to find those kinds of things if you're going to be the leader of a human mess. When we get back to it and going to change, we're dealing with human beings and human beings will come with all that mess. And that's what drives a lot of this facilitation stuff that I'm personally not very good at.
You also need to be curious and empathetic to people. If somebody doesn't want to change, I'm always really curious about why they don't want to change. There are often really interesting little nuggets of gold in the why somebody doesn't want to change. It might not actually be that they don't want to change. I've had a number of conversations with people who seemed really resistant. And actually, when you got into the discussion, you would find something maybe inside the organization that they knew would kind of poison the well against the kind of change we're going to make. And so now you have to go kind of tackle that organizational issue that you learned from having this dialogue with this person. Or sometimes there is somebody who doesn't really want to do it, but if everybody else will, they'll go along with it. When I talk with teams and we're kind of making facilitative decisions, one of the things that I will sometimes use is the gradient of consensus. Not everybody needs to be a 5. Not everybody needs to say, this is the best thing since sliced bread. I want to get rid of the 1s and the 2s, which are the, I think this is a terrible idea, I'm going to actively fight you. And the, I think this is a terrible idea, and I'm just really not go along with this. I'm not going to support it. If I can get somebody to a 3, I don't know if this is a great idea. In Intel, when I worked there years ago, we used to call this disagree and commit. I don't know if this is a great idea, but if everybody else does it, I'll go along for the ride. I may just need to get certain people to level 3. And I'm curious, especially if people have 1s and 2s, again, to be curious about what that is, not sort of immediately just say, well, this person doesn't understand, or this person's a bad person, or they're fighting me. Instead, to be like, well, tell me what your reservations are. Tell me why you see the challenge here. I swear I've found more nuggets of gold in those conversations than the people who are like, I'm 5, I'm all in.
To your point, Earl, when you have someone that might have a input that they don't share in the meeting, I go back to our 10X principles thing. One of the things is grow capability. If you have a person that's always in private telling you some great nugget, your job as a manager or as a scrum master or something like that is to bring that person into a comfort zone where they feel like they can share that in a retrospective and not feel like they're going to get hammered by somebody else in the room. The notion of growing that person's comfort, maybe saying, you say some really good things, you should share them in the open because a lot of your colleagues believe in what you do.
And I may need to go to one of the colleagues and say, hey, we need to let someone else share for a while and listen to them because they may have good ideas.
Now, that's the passive way of saying it. I like your comments, but can you go out and get some donuts while let somebody else talk? Concluding comments, Jenny, anything you want to say just to kind of summarize?
Do your teams enjoy their retrospectives? Do they think the retrospectives are actually making improvements over time? If not, address.
Spot on. How about you, Steve?
You had asked early on about sort of the three keys to success, and I scribbled some notes here. Key one, getting participation, making sure everybody's contributing. Key two is getting some kind of agreement or consensus. And then I would say key three is a plan for action.
Okay, Earl, last word.
Last word. Wow. So talk about things that the team wants to talk about. Don't do things just because it's pro forma, but actually focus on content that they want to talk about and they can take action on. This is something that the team is doing to improve what the team does, not to fix the world, not to make the peace on earth, but to actually say, can we as a team do better what we do as a team going forward? Focus on that and don't have too many balls juggling at the same time. Do one thing well, and then do something else as opposed to trying to do 18 things better, which you get none of.
Mark, can I make one final plug?
Yes, you can.
This is all awesome at the team level. Do it at your product, project, organizational level too.
And we're back out. I hope you heard some good recommendations on inspecting, adapting your own retrospectives here. Best practice mechanics, organizational issues, consensus and goal setting, actionable content, all things that are there for the harvesting. Let's try something new out there. So in the shameless self-promotion category, if you'd like to explore whether your retros are missing the mark in your specific development environment, reach out. We have a lot of experiences that can help, as you undoubtedly heard today. And in closing, thank you, Jenny, Steve, and Earl for that conversation. And I think we'll close it right there. So if you enjoyed this episode, feel free to give us a positive rating on wherever you normally find our podcasts. If you have comments or like to talk to one of our practitioners, or you have ideas for future podcasts, or better yet, want to participate with an idea we can explore together, reach out via email using comments@constructs.com. Again, that's comments@constructs.com. We truly would love to hear from you. Be sure to tune in again for another episode of Inspect and Adapt, the Constructs podcast. Until then, this has been Mark Griffin as your host and Earl Beattie as guest and producer. Talk to you again soon, everybody, and have a great next sprint.